Roll call.
Roll call for Friday, February 1st. Anderson District 2.
Here.
Anderson District 28.
Here.
Barnard.
Here.
Bebout.
Here.
Burns.
Here.
Case. Christensen. Coe. Cooper. Kraft. Dockstader. Driscoll.
Here.
Amrick. Esquibel. Geis.
Here.
Hastert.
Here.
Hicks. Hines.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Landon.
Here.
Meyer. Nicholas.
Here.
Nutting.
Here.
Perkins.
Here.
Peterson.
Here.
Rothfuss.
Here.
Schiffer.
Here.
Scott.
Here.
Von Platern.
Here.
President Ross.
Here.
Hicks. Absent or excused?
Excused. I don't know where he is.
Meyer.
Excused.
28 present, 2 excused.
Prayer by Pastor Whitmore.
Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, today I'm mindful of the peace that you talk about that we can have through you, and I ask that each of these men and women would have your peace today. And not only would they have that peace, but it would lead to perseverance. And God, lastly, that they would have protection as they focus on what they need to do today on Friday, and that you would keep them protected, and that they would be refreshed from the weekend and back at it on Monday. Thank you, God, for, again, the work you are enabling, allowing them to do. Our state is blessed because of them. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Senator
Landon.
President, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Fellow senators, today we have some special guests in the audience. The Abate Riders of Wyoming. They represent Casper, Cody, Gillette, Cheyenne, and Torrington. They're in our North Balcony. And today, fellow senators, is what they refer to as Black Friday. Not only because Senate File 129 did not pass, but also because they like to wear their leathers and ride for freedom and all sorts of things. Would you help me welcome our Abate Riders of Wyoming?
Welcome to the Senate. Reading correction and approval of the journal. Will the reading clerk read the journal committee report?
Mr. President, your journal committee reports that the journal of January the 31st, 2013, has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Jim L. Anderson, Chairman.
Are there any objections? There being none, the report is adopted. The doctor for the day, I may butcher this, Nima Azarbahai, D.O. from Cheyenne. Not very good, was it? Sorry. Apologize to her or him. I don't know. It's getting deeper and deep. Oh, jeez. The nurse for the, there is no nurse again. I think we ran out of nurses in the state of Wyoming. Thought for the day. The most practical kind of politics is the politics of decency. Theodore Roosevelt. Okay, messages from the House.
January the 31st, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 237, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 46, Unfair Employment Practices, ayes 14, noes 44, excused 2. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. Is that where we're at? House Bill 201, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 201, Transfer on Death Deed, sponsored by Representative Blevins, and Act relating to non-testamentary transfers of real property. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1.
House Bill 201 is referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 130, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 130, Education Elective Academic Bible Study, sponsored by Representative Watt, and Act relating to public school elective courses. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 44, noes 15, excused 1.
House Bill 130 is referred to Committee number 4, Education. House Bill 163, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 163, Adjunct Professor Incentives, sponsored by Representative Freeman, and Act relating to teachers. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 36, noes 23, excused 1.
House Bill 163 is referred to Committee number 4, Education. House Bill 208, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 208, Veterans Resident Tuition Provisions, sponsored by Representative Larson, an act relating to education. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 208 is referred to Committee number 4, Education. House Bill 156, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 156, Movement of Livestock in Emergency Situation, sponsored by Representative Hunt, an act relating to inspection of brands. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 156 is referred to Committee number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 155, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 155, Burn Order Violations Restitution, sponsored by Representative Semlick, an act relating to penalties for violating fire bans. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 155 is referred to Committee number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 131, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 131, Game and Game Fish Definition, sponsored by Representative Yagi, an act relating to game fish. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 131 is referred to Committee number 6, Travel. House Bill 18, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill number 18, Telecommunications, Internet Protocol Enabled Services, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, and Act relating to telecommunications. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1.
House Bill 18 is referred to Committee number 7, Corporations. House Bill 147, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 147, Vehicle Registration Fees, Purple Heart Exemption, sponsored by Representative Kasparic, an act relating to motor vehicle registration. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 147 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 161, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 161, Outdoor Advertising Fees, sponsored by Representative Throne, an act relating to highways. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 47, noes 11, excused 1, conflict 1.
House Bill 161 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 182, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 182, Determination of Highway Rights of Way on Federal Land, sponsored by Representative Croker, and Act Relating to Highways. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 182 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 203, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 203, Health Benefit Exchange Study and Select Committee, sponsored by Representative Harvey, an act relating to the administration of government and health insurance exchanges and related functions under federal law. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 44, noes 15, excused 1.
House Bill 203 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Reports from standing committees.
February the 1st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 223, Public Records Institutions of Higher Education. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Barnard, Cole, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Cole, Chairman. January the 31st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 90, Engrossed, Recreation Liability Activities. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass, amended. Ayes, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman. January the 31st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 53, Engrossed, State Land Violation. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass, amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman. January the 31st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 84, Engrossed, Livestock Fence Repairs. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman. January the 31st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 38, Engross, Use of Water Outside the State. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Senate, do you all have your goldenrod? If you'd grab it, please. Oh, they're just being passed out. No, that's the third reading amendment. Another third reading amendment. Probably mine. Mr. President, there's just one thing that I want to bring to the body's attention so you understand some things that are going on. And Mr. President, it's on page 4.
dealing with the school foundation program. And what I want to start with, Mr. President, if you go down to the bottom of the page where it says PLF holding account, you can see under, if you look under the JAC recs, that number is approximately $1.6 million. And what this means, Mr. President, is if with the funding that's going on in the legislative appropriations outside the school foundation program, and there's several items that are profiled, of course they haven't happened. One is the employee compensation outside the foundation program for the K through 12 of $8.1 million. You'll see that under appropriations back up under the foundation program. School safety and security is $2.3 million. When this number drops below the $1.6 million, and if you look at the other school foundation budgetary items coming through, it will. What happens is it goes back up to the top of the page where you see that $100 million by statute. We have to maintain that. Well, since it's not by statute to be able to dip into that, what you have to do again is go back to the bottom and where we stuck in this $450 million that we're going to cap and sort of an LSRA for the foundation program, it will dip into the amount of money that would tip into the permanent fund. Now, the relevance of this is that most of the money that's come up with to make that $450 million doable is COLEIS bonus money. And we all know that's short term, and it could be for the next 7 years. So if you did not have that COLEIS bonus money being diverted to this particular account to build up that $450 million, and the way the spending is going outside the foundation program, you'll be dipping into the PLF holding account. So I guess a better way of saying this is if all this should happen without the COLEIS bonus money, if the PLF holding account was actually your LSRA for the school foundation program, we'd be dipping into that. So I just want the body to understand when we talk about all these different funding scenarios outside the school foundation model itself, that that's a likely scenario that will happen. Do we have the money in there because of what we're doing and the COLEIS bonus to take care of it? We do. But I just wanted to be sure you understood how this was flowing through the school foundation program. And with that, Mr. President, I'll be glad to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. At the request of the Chairman of Appropriations, can I approach you to the floor to take us through
yes, you may.
A little primer on some funds? Thank you.
Is there a handout with that?
Yes, you can. Is there a handout?
All right, thank you. Oh, I better turn your mic on. Sorry. There you go.
There's a lot of people probably would wish you wouldn't turn my mic on, Mr. President. Mr. President, members of the Senate, we just wanted to take through, and some of you would be very acquainted with this. Some of you won't be so acquainted with it, and it's never bad to have a primer on this. And this will be, some of this discussion will become more relevant when we start through the budget bill next week. Some of you may have a number of questions as you looked at the governor's budget message and some of the other things that the Joint Appropriations Committee has recommended some differences to, though, and some of those will become apparent as we discuss next week. We thought it was important for the body to come through and just for their understanding of the budget and, you know, how some of the funding and financing of our state government works to go through this very quickly. I anticipate this will take about 10 minutes or so. You should have a handout, should be out to you. You should have both of them kind of look like this page right here. You'll see here, we're not going to show you anything on the screen that's not going to be on these two pages. You'll have some information that's not on these two pages, but everything that you're going to have is on these two pages, so you can we'll try and take you through up here, but you'll also be able to look at it and make notes on the pages you have in front of you. So we're going to start off with this is the permanent. Let's go back where Jamie. We're on the. Let's start. Go back to the PMT. Oh, Jamie's not there anymore. Let's go back to the PMT.
So this is the
Remember the Senate, this is the schedule, and we have a number of funds that are set up this way. Some of them have little differences and variances, but what we've got is, this is the PMTF. We start up here, this is the Permanent Mental Trust Fund. The Permanent Mental Trust Fund was created in part by the Wyoming Constitution. There's a lot of statutory interaction with it. But what we do is, the money that's deposited in this comes from a couple sources. Constitutionally, we divert 1.5% of our severance taxes into the corpus of the Permanent Mental Trust Fund. Whenever money comes into this, it's held inviolate. We cannot spend it by statute. To dip in and spend money out of the Permanent Mental Trust Fund corpus would require a constitutional amendment. In addition to the constitutional diversion of 1.5% of the severance taxes into this, there's an additional statutory addition of an additional 1% that comes into the Permanent Mental Trust Fund which the legislature did to continue to try and build the Permanent Mental Trust Fund. Just by way of information, for fiscal year 2012, the constitutional diversion of 1.5% of permanent of severance taxes into this equated to about $291 million of additional principal into the Permanent Mental Trust Fund corpus. The statutory addition for 2012 was about $97 million of additional money into the corpus of the PMTF. Now, what we have when we have the PMTF, and we'll get a little bit closer. The PMTF is set up so that the Treasurer's Office either invests or oversees the investment of the corpus. And if you remember, there was a constitutional amendment a few years ago which allows us to take, I believe it's 55% of the Permanent Mental Trust Fund corpus to be invested in securities. And it's not that high. It's somewhere just south of 50% invested in securities at this time. But the object of that was obviously to increase the rate of return in the Permanent Mental Trust Fund. Now, what we do is every year when you get down here, you see in earnings right here, when you get down here, the earnings right here is every year we look at the interest and dividends. If you look at the interest and dividends here in those 2 years, this is what typically is estimated and profiled to come into the general fund each year. And so when we talk about income from the Permanent Mental Trust Fund, the actual earnings on it in interest was a little over $90 million, and on dividends in fiscal year 2012 was a little over $54 million of interest in dividends. That's the income that comes into that. In addition to that, we have realized capital gains that happen from time to time. Obviously, realized meaning that we've sold stock, or we've sold the investments, and we sold them for more than we paid for them, which is a good thing. And so we have capital gains, but that's actually happened. The checks cleared the bank when you sold those, and so we have realized capital gains. See, the realized capital gains for fiscal year 2012 was just south of $100 million. into that, you have direct fees paid, the $8,600,000 here. That is for the various investment, the direct investment costs for commissions and other things that are paid to the professional managers that invest lots of these funds for us. So you see the total investment income for year 2012 then was just shy of $236 million. Now, when we do that, what we did in order to try and make sure that there's a significant or a steady stream of income coming out of the Permanent Mental Trust Fund, the way that it's set up, is you get down to what we call the SPOF. When we talk about these things, we talk about the SPA, which is the spending policy amount. And the spending policy amount initially started out at 8%, but no one believed that was going to be sustainable over the long haul. It was eventually reduced for a number of years. And so since 2004 and thereafter, it's been level at 5% of a certain amount of a calculation out of what the value of the Permanent Mental Trust Fund was in each year. That value is the 5% of the five-year average of the corpus. If you go back up and look at the Permanent Mental Trust Fund, there's a rolling five-year average that we take each year at the end of each fiscal year. We look at what the market value of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund corpus was at that year. We do that for the last 5 years, and then we take 5% of that average, and that 5% of that average is then deposited into the general fund. And that's the amount of money that comes into the general fund. And it's important to note that, because ultimately this ends up being usually the third or fourth largest contributor of general fund money into our general fund. It's accumulated over time. It's become a very significant one of the main sources of funding for our general fund. So we have the 5% comes to the general fund, and that's how much is deposited to the general fund each year. Now what you have over here, when you look over here, you look at the PMTF reserve account over in the lower left or over lower right-hand corner of your first page. And this is what we call the SPRA, which stands for the Spending Policy Reserve Account. So when we talk about the SPRA, we're talking about the spending policy amount, the 5%. When we talk about the SPRA, we're talking about this reserve account. What the Spending Policy Reserve Account does is it captures any amounts that are over and above when you take all the income, which is the interest, dividends, and realized capital gains, to the extent that that total exceeds 5% of the spending policy amount, then the excess of that is then deposited into the reserve account. What happens in that reserve account then is to level out the effects of using this 5%. In some years, we will not have a 5% return out of the corpus of the Permanent Trust Fund. So what we do in years that there's an excess, it's deposited in the reserve account. In years that the total of these does not equal the 5%, you would pull money back out of the reserve account and put it in, and have it into the general fund so that we meet the spending policy amount. And so that what that is to level that out. And that's just to give you a couple of facts, things to know that you need to understand as we do budgeting. When we look at that, if you look right here, where'd we go? Well, I've got information on my, oh, there we go, right here. And you look right here, there's the total investment income for 2012. This right here is the investment income estimate from the CREG, Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, for fiscal year 2013 is $134,200,000 for that year. That is only a profile of the estimated income and dividends that will be received. Craig, neither the Treasurer's Office nor Craig estimates capital gains, realized capital gains or unrealized capital gains. They don't estimate those. So we always anticipate every year there will be some capital gains, but there may also be capital losses. But that's important to note for you to note that for budget purposes, we only do that. This is similar to the situation we do in the school foundation account with respect to COLE's bonuses. We don't use them until we don't recognize them until they're realized. Just to, anyway, continuing on, when you come down, let's see, if we get down, what else did I want to tell you here? I wanted to also demonstrate to you that when we talk about unrealized capital gains, sometimes people want to assume that we're always going to have them. I just wanted to give you an example. In fiscal year 2009, that we actually had, which was obviously a bad year for the stock market and for investments in general, we had unrealized capital losses in that year of $241 million. We had realized capital losses of $119 million. So that in that year, we actually had realized capital losses in that year of $241 million, almost $242 million. So when you look at the inconsistency we have in the stock market, it's not always safe to assume that capital gains will be there each and every year. It's also an interesting discussion when you look at the requirement we have in the Constitution to keep our corpus of the PMTF inviolate. Once you have capital losses in that fund, you have to restore them at some point in time. Those losses were completely restored by the end of 2010. And so, but as a result of that and having to pull capital gains back in to cover those capital losses, that even in the years that there were additional capital gains in 2010 and 2011, certain amounts of those were pulled back in so that the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund was completely repaid for its capital losses. The moral of that story is simply that you cannot always depend on significant capital gains being available either to cover the reserve account or to be available if it got bad enough that it might impact the amount of the 5% to the general fund. Continue on, we're just about to wrap this up. When you get here, one of the things that we did last year that was fairly unique was that in our session laws, we diverted $30 million of excess capital gains that would have gone into the SPRA. We diverted it from this, and I think that if I remember right, that was the $30 million that went to I think it was College of Engineering Tier 1, if I remember right. If I'm wrong on that, I'm sure someone will correct me. Now, finally, the last thing we need to know about this is when you look down here at the bottom, you see the projected balance. One of the things that's important to know about the projected balance is there's no projection for anything to spill over in 2013. That's almost always the case because we don't profile realized capital gains. So that number will never project an increase unless or until we get to the point that income would exceed the 5%, just the income from dividends and interest. When you get down here, the 75% of the SPA, the spending policy amount, is that the reason that number is significant, that $175,235,000, is there's a tipping function in here. Once the reserve account exceeds 75% of the spending policy amount, once you have money in the reserve account that's in excess of the spending policy amount, or 75% of the spending policy amount, the excess then goes up this dotted line, and you look on your sheet, it will actually tip back into the corpus of the permanent mineral trust fund. The objective there is that over time, if we're successful in our investments, then in addition to the additions from severance tax, we'll have certain capital gains, excess capital gains will eventually go over there, and hopefully can help assist in inflation proofing. I can tell you that in the last 10 years, there's been approximately, there's been roughly $271 million is tipped back into the permanent mineral trust fund and increased the corpus by that amount. So anyway, just one other thing I would share with you is as you think about capital gains and whether or not you think they ought to be profiled and spent in advance, just to give you an example, if you go to the back up in your box at the permanent mineral trust fund and look at the average at the end of fiscal year 12, which was 7.1 of 2012, there was just shy of $6 billion in there, $5,595,000,000 in the PMTF corpus. As of 12/31/2012, so just 1 month ago, that number was down by $130 million over the course of the year. So I can tell you that this thing will vary, the market values of the corpus will vary by tens of millions each day as the stock market goes up and down. So it's important to recognize that capital gains are very iffy and that there's good reasons why people are uncomfortable profiling them. So with that, we'll go very quickly into the Common School Permanent Land Fund, which will go very quickly because it's really essentially the same, but we'll stop here and ask for any questions on our chart or anything we've discussed so far.
Questions?
We'll start here and work from my left to my right, so we'll start with Senator Burns.
Well, wait.
Me.
I actually
it's you're the boss. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Well, I would be happy to have let you do that, but I got to control their mic. Well, Senator Burns.
Thank you, President Perkins.
Oh, that hurts.
Mr. President, just a little, if I can get a little better understanding on the realized capital gains. So first of all, is that a net figure? So you're combining the capital gains with the capital losses to come out with this figure? In case anybody's confused.
Thank you. Do you know who the boss is?
Yes, sir. I don't know if your Majesty. I don't know if you went to Burger King or if you eat Imperial Margarine. But anyway, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. and that's a good question. And the answer is a little bit. Unfortunately, the answer is a little bit cloudy. That is the net amount at the end of the fiscal year. So when you look at, I'm assuming Senator Burns is referring to when you look at the realized capital gains that you have in the PMTF investment earnings box, which is this number right here, right there, realized capital gains of the $99,803,000. I'm assuming that's what we're referring to?
Yes. Mr. President, is that a net figure?
Yes, that would be the net figure of capital gains matched against, as I understand it, realized capital gains matched against realized capital losses.
Okay.
For the year.
So, Mr. President, I guess where I'm having a little difficulty, first of all, is in the idea that they bought a stock back in 1990, 20 years ago, let's say Coca-Cola or something. Oh, I shouldn't use brand names. But let's say a large stock, large cap stock. And the stock went up over 20 years, and it went from a value of $100,000 that it was bought at, and it sold at $500,000. Then that $400,000 difference is now moved down into income. Am I correct? And it seems that it's kind of a Rube Goldbergian way of adjusting for inflation to go all the way down to the reserve account, and then anything that happens to be left over spill back. And Mr. President, I guess my concern is that $400,000, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, that $400,000 difference, there's nothing taken into account for inflation between 1990 and now.
Senator Perkins? And I think that's exactly right. And I think that's important, and that's why as you look and contemplate being able to capture and spend capital gains, I think you want to be very careful because of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President, just to follow up on that, the purpose of, this was developed after what my recollection is the Yale Foundation Trust. And the purpose for creating the SPA amount and then the SPRA account was to accommodate for this issue where you would take your equities and you would take all your losses and gains, net them out. You were targeting about 8% revenue over the long term, but you're going to have these aberrations where you have a massive increase or a particular loss. And those monies move into the SPRA account, and then at some point it hits the 75% tip and goes back to inflation-proof the corpus. And you have to have some mechanism to do that, and it was modeled after that trust. You can go research it. And so there was a purpose in doing it. Now, Mr. President, there are really two things that we need to think about, though, there are three things that we've done to interrupt the process that we can reinstate and probably should reinstate at some time. One, we started out with a target of 8% was we were going to hit. We lowered it to 5% because, frankly, we didn't need the 8%. And second, the stock market wasn't yielding that kind of ongoing gains. So statutorily, we took the targeted 8%, lowered it to 5%. The second thing that happened is the Treasurer, when we had the large losses in the stock market where there was about $1 billion of loss, the Treasurer decided to stretch out those losses over 3 years and pick up the losses over 3 years that would allow more income going into the, or more income to go through the essentially the flow charts that you see there. And we had great concern that the Treasurer could alter, at that time himself, his own policies to stretch out those losses and then to make sure, and you know, a Treasurer always wants to have at least a corpus that he came in with when he goes out. So they stretched out those losses and took 3 years to recover it. So there would be some income, but at the same time, provide an opportunity to make sure that the corpus got back. So there are some policy decisions that are made by the Treasurer. So that's the second thing that when we had hearings on it, we finally said, that's fine. We do want you need to pick up those losses, and you're free to carry over and recover them over 3 years. But bottom line is, the final thing that you have to remember is this. The SPA amount, the spending policy amount, which you see in the chart right behind Senator Perkins, that says that the SPA amount is the 5% or $92 million. The idea was that you would budget the SPA amount. And if your interest and earnings did not reach the SPA amount, you would reach into the SPRA account and pull out the difference. And we suspended that, and we've had it suspended. And there's a benefit to us, which I'll describe. The benefit is that even the reason we didn't do it, frankly, is because we didn't feel we needed that extra income in the general fund. And when we suspended the reach into the SPRA account, and what we know was happening is if we were targeting 5% revenue, and the treasurer was forecasting about 2.5% on the fixed income side of the ledger, and not forecasting any capital gains. So we were budgeting only the 2.5% out of the 5%. Over the last 2 years, we have exceeded the total 5% because our capital gains have exceeded more than the balance of the 2.5%. Because we didn't budget them for expenditure, when the revenues arrived, they were above our forecasts, above the goldenrod, and the amounts, the difference between what we forecasted and the 5% SPA amount, spending policy amount, was sweeping into the LISRA account, our rainy day, our rainy season account, whatever you want to call it. And that's when a large amount of the growth in the legislative stabilization reserve account has been those unforecasted and unbudgeted capital gains. Now, if we go back to the original concept, that wouldn't happen because if you budgeted the SPA amount and you said we're going to spend it, the only question is it going to come from the unforecasted capital gains or are we going to reach into the SPRA account and pull it out? So remember, the SPRA account is a leveling account. 1 year you pull out, 1 year you put in, but there'd always you could always pull out, and the idea was to target an even 5%. And we have taken advantage of that to that interruption of the SPA policy. And by interrupting the SPA policy, we are budgeting less money than we know is going to become available. It has grown the LISRA account. And we had a purpose. Because of that, we have gotten into discussion that, hey, there's likely to be revenues in excess of your fixed income, odds are, that will probably reach the 5% threshold. And so we've gotten into discussion about unforecasted capital gains. We wouldn't even have that discussion if we were simply adhering to the SPA policy. That is, you budget the SPA amount, and you either get it from capital gains or you get it from drawing back out of the SPRA account, and you would budget and you would spend it. And one of the things that our chief executive officer, the governor, has indicated is a displeasure that the amounts aren't budgeted and they can't be spent. But we have used that as a very conservative vehicle to reduce the SPA, even though we know the SPA will be available, we've reduced our budgeting. We've used that surplus, when it comes in, the unforecasted and unbudgeted amount, to build the LISRA account. And it's been a great policy. But I can see that maybe over the next 2 or 3 years, if things really do get tight, we may have to reinstate the whole SPA policy where we say we're just going to budget 5%. And we don't, we just don't know where the money's coming from, capital gains, fixed income, or whether we're going to have to reach into the SPRA account and pull it out. And we can do all those things, and it's available to us. But what we're doing now is an interruption, and we may reinstate that at some time, anytime we choose to. And the discussion about unrealized and unbudgeted capital gains only comes up because we've interrupted that policy.
Thank you. Mr. President?
Senator Perkins.
And just to follow on with the majority floor leader, as in the deferral, what you had in May 2009 because of the large stock market crash, the question is whether you would have to use both income and dividends as well as realized capital gains to restore any capital losses to the corpus of the permanent trust fund. The treasurer, in consultation with the Select Committee on Capital Finance and Investments, who reviewed the policy with the treasurer, adopted he would basically allow those to be, that you would simply kind of hold those as basically an IOU. Like we talked about earlier, there was in fiscal year 2009, there was a realized capital losses of $119 million. $59.5 million of that was recovered and restored to the corpus out of realized capital gains in fiscal year 10, and this, with almost an identical amount in fiscal year 11, so that was completely repaid. The net effect of that, Mr. President, just to show you some of the issues we have with forecasting realized net capital gains, I'll just run through the last 5 years. Realized net capital gains in fiscal year 2008 was $189 million. In realized capital gain in 2009, because it was a very tough year, $2.5 million. And in fiscal year 10 was $7.7 million. In fiscal year 11 was $93.1 million. And at the end of fiscal year 12 was $99.8 million. So those capital gains do go all over the map. With respect to that. So I think there were a couple other questions, Mr. President. I don't know if they're still available.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund Reserve account, what's happening to the earnings from that account, even if they're investing it relatively short-term, they're getting some earnings, what happens to them?
Mr. President, I will double-check that, but I believe that those earnings are captured inside the reserve account. I can check that and get back to the body with that answer, but that's my recollection. No?
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, if that was true, the end fiscal year 12 balance, you got 144,315. You got the same projected for FY13. And balance. If that was true, the balance there should be growing. It's going somewhere that's outside this account.
We'll report back, Mr. Okay. President.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, I have two questions and they're related. The first one, when we have a capital stock loss in that inviolate fund, is there any guidelines or restrictions on how soon that have to be replaced? And then my second question, that 1% that we are diverting to the permanent mineral fund, would that count as making up a loss in the inviolate fund?
Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, the policy that the Treasurer adopted on his interpretive policy that went into effect on July 1st of 2008, was simply that earnings and dividends would be treated as ordinary income and just always dispersed and would not go back to recover realized capital gains inside the inviolate fund. Capital gains would then are carried forward through into the next year. So those losses are, and it's an IOU going forward that has to be restored. It was not discussed that I remember, and I don't know why that it couldn't, but ultimately the 1% I believe probably could, although it hasn't been identified and treated as an opportunity to recover, to hold those funds inviolate. But so I think the answer is I don't think it probably could be, but it hasn't been.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. From my understanding is, as Senator, that that actually the PMTF, according to the, I believe the Treasurer's Office, actually they maintain two different bases for that, two different amounts. One is like a market value rated amount, and one is like a current update. And maybe that question's already been asked as we went around here, but I wasn't quite sure I could pull that out of what some of the answers were. So is as that fund either gains or loses, in particularly I'm talking about the probably the more the securities market end of the thing. I mean, the thing goes up and down sometimes, but is there two different reporting numbers that we use on that? And if it is it included in this chart and how we describe that, or am I kind of off base here?
Mr. President, now are you referring to the book value versus the market value? Okay, right. The as anybody would if you look at your IRA, your investment portfolio, you have to track the cost basis. You have to, which is generally looked at as I believe the book value. You track the cost basis of your investment so that ultimately when you sell, you know whether you have a gain or loss with respect to that. So both of those numbers are carried forward. As we've talked about before, the SPA amount is determined off the SPA amount is determined off of the the fair market value as of the end, whether you want to call it the end of the fiscal year or the first day of the beginning of the fiscal year. So we're dealing with the fair market values on that day, but the unrealized gains and losses are computed as the difference between the market values and the cost basis or the book values.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. And when the Treasurer begins to analyze the corpus for the purposes of what constitutes the inviolate corpus, that is a different analysis, and it's based upon what were the contributions, how much have we put into the account, and that's our corpus amount that's inviolate. Now, everything becomes inviolate, but as you're making the capital gains analysis and the recovery of it, they do keep an eye on what that corpus is and what were the cash contributions. When you see the valuations that are reported, those are the fair market value marked to market, which may be different because until the capital gains are actually realized, you know, once they're realized, they may affect the constitutional corpus value. But there is an analysis there that has to be made at some point because when we have this discussion about taking a large loss and recovering the loss before you begin to reflect income, you would have to know what your corpus value is against which you have to regain. But so that's a little bit different analysis than when you look to the, and you can have a corpus value that's higher than your valuation mark to market, as we did when we had the stock market crash. And so that's the difficulty. If your corpus value was $5 billion and you lost $1 billion in reserves, then the question is do you have to take all your income and replace your corpus to $5 billion before you can kick off any revenues? Because your value marked to market changed almost a half a billion after the stock market. So on that very next day, if you sold a bunch of stock, as the Sheridan legislator is describing, you said, well, that's all income. You can't treat it all as income because you have not returned to your corpus, which is inviolate. And recognizing that, the Treasurer made some adjustments. Well, I'm not going to recover all those losses to my corpus value over 1 year. I'm going to spread it out over 2 to 3 years. And we were complicit in that because we were told what was happening. It made sense at the time. So, yes, there is an accounting system to keep track of what your corpus value is. But at all times when you see these reports, what you're looking at is the value, the fair market value today, which is marked to market And much of that, you might have as much as $500 million to $1 billion that have not been realized because the accounts have not been rebalanced and or the stock's not sold to capture those gains.
Senator Coe.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just, you know, as we debate the philosophies and the strategies, and I want to say that, you know, a lot of our unanticipated revenues came about from capital gains that we just couldn't project were going to be there. But I think it's interesting that we discuss this right now, and I just happened to get a press release here a couple of minutes ago that I think is really relevant to what we do with our permanent funds. And as the market, as the Dow Jones bumps up to record all-time highs, and I'm telling you it's bumping up around 14,000, which would be a record all-time high, and I can tell you that I would take it to the bank or bet in Vegas that I'd be right that we'll see more than $134 million of realized capital gains in 2013. But just let me make you aware of this press release that just came out. It says, Wyoming maintains highest credit rating. I got this about 10 minutes ago. Standard & Poor's rating service, S&P, announced that Wyoming will continue to receive a AAA rating, the highest credit rating possible. They go on to say that it says that the financial management practices are rated as good. And S&P made note of several points here. The state's economic strength in recent years with above-average population growth, lower-than-average unemployment, and above-average income levels, that's one point. The governor's strong statutory ability to make mid-biennium cuts in the event of revenue shortfalls, regular consensus revenue forecasting, Wyoming's maintenance of large general fund balances, the existence of a permanent fund whose interest earnings are available for general fund expenditures, and low overall debt and other post-employment benefits, liabilities, and moderate pension liabilities. So I just want to say that the way we're doing stuff here, we're doing it better than anybody else in the country. Honestly, we are. And I admire how we do this. I was involved in the 5% spending policy on the Select Committee on Cap Finance 4 or 5 years ago, and I commend the way we manage our money. I think it's a conservative approach to it, and I commend the Appropriations Committee for their direction over the last 5 to 6 years. I just bring that up for the body's benefit.
Thank you, Senator Coe. Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, that's a good point. I think when you're talking to your constituents, when you're returning, and you see a report that on such and such day, the Treasurer rebalanced the permanent mineral trust fund or sold gains and got $100 million of income or $200 million. And the reaction of your constituents are, well, how can you say we don't have money? Because if we had if you're making money like that, you ought to be paying our salary increases. Teachers ought to be getting a great amount. But here's the bottom line that is easiest for me to describe it. And this is what I ask the treasurers when I'm down in their office. What we're banking on when we have a 5% spending policy amount, we're banking on that your average income over, say, 6 to 10 years is higher than 5%, the average. And on some years, you're going to have below 5%, some years above 5%. When you get to above the 5%, you're going to build and inflation-proof your corpus. And I'll tell you what, if you walked down to the treasurer's office today and you said, hey, I see you captured a lot of money, but tell me this, are we on target to hit even 5% return on the permanent mineral trust fund? And the answer is going to be, we wish. And so part of the reason when I said we stripped off the probably should have said, not only did we do it because we were building the LISRA account, the rainy day season, or the rainy season account, but the other reason we popped off the 5% requirement is because we weren't sure we were going to get 5% average over a period of time. We're still getting, it's comparatively a large amount of money. But we have not had a sustainable 5% rate of return, considering both fixed and equity income over the last few years. And all you need to do is go look at our retirement account, which is based upon an 8% return, and we're now $1 billion underwater. So when you hear these numbers, simply say, the whole idea is that we would try to hit 5%. We haven't hit the 5%. When we start hitting 5, when the folks that are in the stock market business and investments tell you, hey, when you put your money into your 401k account, you can pretty well count on seeing a 5% return over the next 10 years, that's the time to relax. We're not there yet. But it is interesting to note that we do get large amounts off of this trust because of the actions of our predecessors, and it's a great thing to have.
Mr. President?
Just a moment. Senator. Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And I believe my colleague from Natrona County had a question about the SPRA interest. That goes to the general fund. That's the first thing. Mr. President, the other thing I would mention is we're having in the budget bill, you will see that we're going to maintain the statutory diversion of the 1% into the permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. If you listen to what Senator, my colleague from Park County just talked about our credit rating, the main thing I heard from that is the strength of our permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. And if you go back to the 90s, and a lot of us remember those times and the difficulties our state faced, back then that permanent fund generated revenues to the general fund of about 25% of our general fund expenditures. That has dropped down. And I think there are times in the last 3 or 4 years where that was down to 15%. Part of it is because we're spending more, but part of it is because the permanent fund hasn't grown to the extent to generate the interest that we need to offset for our general fund expenditures. So the answer to me is we look past the rest of this biennium, the next biennium, down the road, and in the rest of this decade, even further out, is we need to build our permanent mineral trust fund. That's that safety valve we had for our state for the general fund expenditures, which is why your appropriations committee, when you see the budget bill, the supplemental budget bill, you see in there that we maintain that statutory diversion of 1%. It's about $140 million a year. That $140 million a year goes into the permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. And members of the Senate, that's a major policy decision that we will make next week to continue to do that or not to do it. I would hope and suggest that we continue to do it, and that's the position your Joint Appropriations Committee has taken.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. I really appreciate our Vice President bringing up something that I wanted to follow up on with a question. When you talk about that 1%, I believe I'm hearing that would come out of the SPRA and what tips back into the permanent mineral trust fund. I'm getting a head shake. No. So, my concern, maybe a little bit of conversation to my good friend from Natrona County as to when we hear about legislation coming over from the other side or proposals that we even talk about in here that would interrupt the flow of monies to permanent funds. Generally, what are we talking about? Is it the money that's tipping into that SPRA account that we're going to interrupt that flow? And then that does play into what the Vice President's saying, which is that's interrupting a flow of money that is going to inflation-proof the permanent mineral trust fund, does it not?
Mr. President. Senator Perkins.
And just follow up on my colleague from Natrona County and his question, and we'll go back and there are two main sources that annually flow into the corpus of the permanent mineral trust fund. The first is a constitutional diversion or contribution of severance taxes of 1.5% of the Wyoming severance taxes. That goes in. That in 2012, the fiscal year 2012, that was roughly $291 million that came in. That's a constitutional flow. In addition to that, probably about 7 years ago, if I remember right, there, in addition to that 1.5%, there's an additional what we oftentimes refer to as the statutory diversion. The statutory diversion is generally an additional 1% of the severance taxes. In 2012, that was $97 million. Typically, when you talk about, when people talk about, or there's legislation or bills that come out that talk about taking money out of this severance tax, we're talking about that 1% statutory diversion. Constitutionally, we can't interrupt the 1.5% constitutional diversion, but we can interrupt and have in the past interrupted temporarily from time to time the statutory additions of the 1% diversion to the PMTF.
Okay. Folks, we're going to need to move along here. So, Senator Meyer.
Just briefly, Mr. President. The good senator from Park County mentioned why we had one of the reasons why we have some good credit ratings. He did mention, though, that we only have moderate liabilities for our pension, and JAC's done a lot of work on that. This is a topic we'll look at later, but we have to move toward eliminating those pension liabilities, and that's another topic here that we'll work on.
Thank you. Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, something wrong in the numbers. In 2012, if 1.5% was $291 million, 1% can't be $97 million. I think the $140 million we heard from the appropriations chairman might be correct, but it can't be $97 million. That's too low if 1.5% is $291
million. And Mr. President, what I'm referring to and looking at is as part of the Treasury report with respect to just additions to the Permanent Trust Fund, and I may be they have broken out the constitutional severance tax of 1.5% deposit. Then they have the additional severance taxes. I think that's also because I think the 1% is also below the cap. I think it's only severance taxes below the cap. And so there's a limit on that. I will check and get back to you with a more specific answer why the differential.
Okay. How are we doing here?
Mr. President, the next one I think will be really quick because all we're going to do is it's the same model for the common school. If you just turn the page to your next one, you'll see another picture that looks very much the same. It's a spending policy reserve account. It says CSPLF, which stands for the Common School Permanent Land Fund. You'll see that it's set up very much, there we go. You see it's set up very much the same way. The same thing happens. The only thing that may be of note in here is when you get down over here, is that when you get down over into this circle right here with this automatic appropriation, there is a swap that happens in here where you swap out the Common School Permanent Land Fund excess earnings in excess of the spending policy amount, still flow to the Common School Land Income Fund and the School Foundation Program account, but a swap of funds occurs as an automatic appropriation from the federal mineral royalties is made to the Common School Permanent Land Fund. These FMRs would otherwise deposit in the School Foundation Program account. And so as there's a swap that occurs, sometimes it makes a difference about the character and nature, but there is a swap. But other than that, it's very similar and almost identical to what happens in the PMTF. And if there's no more questions, that finishes our presentation, Mr. President.
Thank you. Senator Hicks.
President, could I have the privilege of the floor?
May.
Members of the Senate in the galley today with us is members from Devon Energy from around the state of Wyoming. We have people from the Gillette office, the Worland office, the Riverton office, the Bags office, and from corporate headquarters in Oklahoma. I also have on the privilege to have on the floor a good friend, Bob and Annette Dunkley. Bob is the senior production foreman for Devon and Energy and Bags. I will tell you they are one of our best corporate partners in the state of Wyoming. I would ask for you to give them a warm welcome to the Senate.
Welcome to the Senate. We are now at that order of business. Builds on second reading. Senate File 146, second reading of Senate File.
Senate File 146, termination of parental rights.
Senate File 146, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection is so ordered. Senate File 149, second reading of the Senate File.
Senate File 149, complementary hunting licenses.
Senate File 149 has some amendments. The reading clerk will read in second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 149.
Senate File 149, second reading amendment 1, page 1, line 4.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, when this bill was introduced yesterday, there was an appropriation attached as a standing committee amendment, and it was voted down, and I was in the chair at the time, so I couldn't give a fuller explanation of the standing committee amendment and why that appropriation is necessary. Mr. Chairman, if everybody would look where pieces of paper are put, they'll find something with my name up in the upper right-hand corner. It says Senate File 149, today's date. And what that is a citation of a statute from 2007, Mr. President, that at the time we had realized that over decades and decades, every few years at least, we would find some of this feel-good legislation that would provide free or reduced hunting licenses for one or another group. I'm sure they're all deserving. But all these were coming at the expense, at great expense to the game and fish. And so what the legislature did in its infinite wisdom in 2007 was said, okay, anytime you've got one of these complimentary licenses or reduced price licenses, you've got to pay for them. You've got to reimburse game and fish for them. And that's what this particular amendment does.
Senator Burns, would you move the amendment, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I move second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 149.
Thank you.
And, Mr. President, the good senator from Bags wanted to know yesterday.
I don't know that all of us have that amendment. At least we don't over here. Yeah. I got one, but it's...
Got it?
You too.
Never mind.
I just gave it to...
Senator Burns.
I just gave it to iVotes.
Go ahead, Senator Burns.
So, Mr. President, the reason that the senator, good senator from Bags, asked a good question as to why it's that amount. Why is it the non-resident amount? And the reason is that if you look at the handout from yesterday for 149, you can see a number of these organizations which benefit wildlife in different aspects of wildlife. There's pheasants this, and there's trout that, and bighorn sheep this. And these licenses go to them for auction, and there's no way for Game and Fish to be able to figure out who exactly bought them, so they get the non-resident price back. Mr. President, I don't think, frankly, that it's legal for 149 to pass without this amendment on it, because it would be in violation of 23.1504. So I urge the passage of this amendment.
Discussion on the amendment, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I guess I understand the policy that we've made in the past to say that if we're going to strip off specialty licenses, give them to groups for fundraising, that we ought to pay out of the general fund. But, you know, folks, there are a couple reasons why we do this, but one of the principal reasons why the policy that we came up with to say let's replace it from the general fund is when we had a lot of general fund money, when we had billions of dollars of excess revenue. Part of the purpose for these specialty licenses really is to advertise hunting, to promote hunting, which, in fact, drive up the licenses, create enthusiasm. And it would be no different than saying that to the extent that Game and Fish has an advertising budget, we ought to pay for their advertising budget. I'd urge you to vote no on the amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment? Senator Burns, for your second time.
Mr. President. It's more than just advertising hunting. It is actually, in many cases, the main fundraiser for a lot of these organizations that whose sole purpose are to preserve the wildlife habitat of our various wildlife, bighorn sheep, goats, moose, elk, and so forth. I think it's a lot more than that. And if there is concern over the fact that we're reimbursing them, I think we should either revisit that law that we put in 2007, or revisit a number of the reduced and free licenses that we give out.
Senator Dockstader, Senator Burns has already taken his second time. Sorry. This second reading amendment number one to Senate file. Yes.
Actually, an inquiry. Would this have to be a roll call vote?
Yes, sir. I was just about to say so.
Oh, thank you.
Second reading amendment number one to Senate File 149 does have an appropriation on it, and by our rules requires a roll call vote. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson District 2?
No.
Anderson District 28?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout? Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
No.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
No.
Perkins? Peterson?
No.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Bonflatern?
Aye.
President Ross?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 19 ayes, 11 noes.
Second reading amendment number one to Senate File 149 is passed. We have another amendment, second reading amendment number two to Senate File 149. Reading clerk will read that amendment.
Senate File 149, second reading amendment number 2, page 2, line 3.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, members of the Senate, all this does is specify, because there's two types. We have both a cow and a bull permit when it comes to wild bison. This just delineates as to which one of those that the governor could do, up to two bull permits, which inevitably means that there'd be three cow permits.
Senator Bebout.
Point of order, he needs to move the amendment.
Oh, excuse me. Please move the amendment.
Mr. President, if I may move second reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 1, I would move second reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 149.
Thank you.
Members of the body, as I described previously, this just designates whether male or female bisons the governor could designate. Let me tell you the rationale for this is the most hard to draw permit in the state of Wyoming is a mountain goat, because we only issue about 23, 24 mountain goat permits. The second hardest draw permit, one of the hardest draw permits in the state of Wyoming for the general population, is a bison permit. We typically only do about 100 bull bison permits a year. So we also know that we're starting to run out or limited on the number of cow bison hunters. There's not a big demand there. So what this just says is we're just going to allow two of those male bull bisons to be donated and put those other three out there. Cow permits could also be donated by the governor, but it just starts to bring into some parity level for the resident population and the non-residents that are trying to draw these very difficult tags, which is the bull bison permit. Just limits those in scope. I would ask for your favorable consideration on second reading amendment.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you know, I don't know what the population is between cows and bulls, and I don't know how the Game and Fish regulates it. I assume that they do it just like deer or anything else. They take a census and they issue maybe more bull permits or more cow permits from year to year, depending on what the biology is, what the habitat is, how much feed is out there. I'm not sure, but I would think that if we just had the ability of the game and fish to direct the number, at some years it might be five male wild bison licenses or bull licenses, and some years it might be none. You know, but for us to put it in the statute seems like we really kind of tie the hands of the game and fish and what biology might be out there in the environment. So I guess my question is, do we need to tie the hands in statute? And if the population gets out of balance, I'm just wondering why we need to do this or why they can't handle it internally.
Senator Burns.
So why? Mr. President, I'm against the amendment. Mr. President, on two counts. One is, I think the good senator from the southeast part of the state is exactly right. To put this in statute ignores the ebbs and flows of the herd. My understanding is that currently there's an overabundance of bison, and it wouldn't be a problem. But more importantly, these licenses raise funds for a lot of these organizations, and these are good organizations. And frankly, if a lot of these organizations weren't doing what they're doing, the state would have to step in and do a lot of that. It actually saves a lot of money because of the money that comes in for these auctions. If this amendment passed, I don't know, for instance, the five organizations that are listed on the handout, I don't know how the government would say you only get a cow, but you get a bull. There are plenty of bison right now, of bull bison right now, and for the foreseeable future. As a matter of fact, I think there's another bill to actually increase the quotas or increase the number of bison that can be taken in order to try and cut down the surplus we currently have.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Scott.
Yes, nays, please, Mr. President.
Ayes and nays have been called for. Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I understand what we're trying to do there and refine it, but perhaps if we do leave it a little more open, it was estimated that those five wild bison permits would generate about $100,000 to $200,000 for conservation projects.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Hicks, for your second time.
Mr. President, in all deference to my good colleague from Sheridan County, he's obviously didn't do extremely well in biology, because if we have an overabundance and you want to get to the reproductive portion of the herd, that's the cows. They're the ones that reproduce and have calves, not the bulls. But getting back to the question of game and fish directed, just a biological fact, Mr. President. Anyway, as far as game and fish direction, this has nothing to do with game and fish. You're going to designate to the governor five permits. It doesn't matter the ebb and flow of the wildlife populations, the winters or the wolves or whatever coming down. It's five bison permits a year. Game and fish doesn't have any authority over this. This is the governor. He gets to issue five regardless of what the population is. Let's talk about separating these out. We've already done that. He gets five. The governor gets five sheep, five moose, 15 elk. This just says he gets five bison, of which two are bulls, two are cows. Or three are cows. Three. I do understand the reproductive physiology of our senator. Yeah, as Mr. President has pointed out, I'm good on the reproductive physiology, but I'm not a mathematician. So, you know, the argument that game and fish could control this has nothing to do with game and fish. You pass this legislation, it's the governor's discretion. Absolutely right. Let's talk about what this does. The value of these. What's a wild bison permit worth? Well, on the open market, I can tell you South Dakota gets about $5,000 a permit to go hunt on the National Wildlife Bison Range. If you go to Arizona and you hunt down there free-roaming bison, it's $5,000. If you go to Alaska, it's $3,000. If you go to Utah, it's $3,000. The estimate that this is going to generate hundreds and thousands of dollars is probably erroneous. The market value is probably between 5 to 10 on a bull. Certainly is much less on the cow. But let's talk about why I put this in there. You do these 5 bull permits, they're priced out of the market for probably the majority of the people in Wyoming to be able to go to these organizations and bid on these. The cows are going to bring less. That's absolutely a fact. What they do is they put it in a market that somebody might not otherwise be able to have an opportunity to buy a permit, is to buy one of these cow permits and actually go hunt. Does it still generate revenue? Yes. Is it 10% or 90% less than a bull permit is? Absolutely. Keep in mind, this is the second most limited permit in the state of Wyoming is these bull bison permits. The previous discussion on the amendment was absolutely right. You put 5 bulls in there, probably every single one of those is going to go to a non-resident. Those are $2,500 licenses. That's why the 12-5 is in there. That's where they're going to go. The only thing this bill does is says, let's add a little parity. The governor still gets to issue them, regardless of the ebbs and flows in the herd. It just provides 5 or 3 opportunities for other people to get in and have an opportunity to purchase a conservation license. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Chief Clerk, call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
No.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
No.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Esquibel.
Geis,
aye. Hastert, Hicks,
aye.
Hines,
no.
Johnson,
no.
Landon,
no.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Rothfuss,
no.
Schiffer,
no.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
no.
President Ross.
No.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 15 ayes, 15 noes.
Ooh. Second reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 149 has failed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. To the sponsor of the bill, I'm curious whether they know, or if not, maybe they could tell us on third reading, but I'm interested to know what the constitutional basis for this is. When we hear now that it has nothing to do with advertising, it has nothing to do to raise revenue, and all we're doing is taking an asset of the state and giving it to the governor and offering, allowing him to gift it to an organization, and hopefully, I suppose, it's one, an organization that you love, and the state, we hear from the Game and Fish folks that it's a loss of revenue from them, and they expect us to make it out of the general fund. If we had excess property, these desks here, we wouldn't, I think the law would prohibit us from saying, Governor, just go ahead and give it to a charity. We do have a provision that says that we can't appropriate funds for, or no appropriation shall be made for charitable, industrial, benevolent purposes unless the institution, the corporation, or recipient is under the absolute control of the state. And I know it's great to have be the governor and give out the state's assets, give out the money, but as I hear the debate today that we're finding out, it has nothing to do with advertising, nothing to do with building the assets. It's we're taking assets away and gifting away instead of through the permit process. Or I suppose we could give the governor a reservoir and say, that's your water. You can give it to any organization you want and raise the money, and you can give it to the revenues raised to your charity of the choice. But I'm kind of curious where the constitutional basis is as we're morphing and evolving this plan.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, in the words of the great George Washington Plunkett of Tammany Hall, what's the Constitution among friends?
Senator Burns. I thought you were getting ready to speak.
I was till the sponsor got up, Mr. Chairman. I'll defer to him, actually.
Okay. Senator Dockstader.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. As far as the constitutional basis, perhaps I get him a little more information on that, but I think that if that was part of the discussion, it should have been brought up with, when we have these precedent-setting cases with the bighorn sheep and the moose and the other licenses that have already been entered into this program.
Thank you. Senator Burns?
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I think that these organizations that the governor gives these licenses to that raise money from have a tangible benefit to the state, and that is for wildlife, the preservation of wildlife, and each one of them is specialized, be it a bighorn sheep, bighorn sheep, or a goat, or a moose, or elk, or mule deer. And these are people, these are organizations of people who have a specific interest in those specific animals. And as I said before, if they weren't doing this, I think Game and Fish would have to be filling in to do it. And it is preservation of habitat, and they do a lot toward that, and they do a lot toward the benefit of these particular herds. And I don't think anybody has any questions the benefit that wildlife has to the state of Wyoming.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, maybe a way that we could actually go around this is to, rather than use general funds, is to use funds from the Wildlife Trust. And the Wildlife Trust works with a lot of these folks in cooperation, and essentially it would be almost like an arm's-length transaction that they pay the $12,005, and they would contract for services more or less, and it would all wash out. So, I think that's the way to actually get around the constitutional issue that may be prevalent in this and the previous ones, as has been the practice for years, that if we go through the Wildlife Trust and because it's for habitat and these folks do habitat, you might be able to do it and then stand on firmer ground than just being a friend.
Thank you. Senate file 149, having been read two separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate file 152, second reading of the Senate file.
Senate file 152, overspending budget's penalty.
Senate file 152, having been read two separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate file 160, second reading of the Senate file.
Senate file 160, pesticides.
Senate file 160, there is an amendment. Second reading amendment number 1 to Senate file 160 will please be read in.
Senate file 160, second reading amendment number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move second reading amendment number 1 to Senate file 160 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. Mr. President, as we looked at this bill yesterday, and this is on the amendment, Mr. President, as we looked at this bill yesterday, primarily what alerted me and started me into this amendment was when we looked at the bill on page 8, that I saw that there we were removing the word registered pesticide from the bill. And so, Mr. President, and I went out and talked with some people in the lobby and found out that this entire act, which starts at 357.350, is known as the Wyoming Environmental Pesticide Control Act. And, Mr. President, what I found out as I went back and printed off and read the entire act, what I found was what I considered to be an incredible, and this is what the amendment addresses, an incredible intrusion into the lives of Wyoming citizens. So what I did in the amendment is I've come back. This bill was represented as an opportunity to update and to further and tighten up and modernize the licensing situation with respect to certified applicators. And certified applicators are those individuals who are licensed by the Department of Agriculture, and you can either be a commercial applicator, or you can be a private applicator, Mr. President, and then you go out and you have the ability to do these registered use pesticides, and you can do with them what you will, as long as you have your license and you have the training. What I found as I went through the bill was that there are numerous instances
where this, all of a sudden, all of us, anybody who walks in and buys a bottle of certain type of herbicides or things like that, or if you, Mr. President, if you sprayed a wasp killer at a moth and it's not on the label, that we're committing crimes. And so I looked at that and I thought, man, this, Mr. President, is probably government intrusion at its worst. And I've been told that your choices are, would you rather have an inspector from the Department of Ag come and knock on your door and tell you that he's got the right to inspect your shed and see what's happening with your pesticides, even if you're not a commercial applicator. And so I went through, and what the amendment does is simply it goes through and pulls that back and narrows it down so the focus of the act is primarily on commercial applicators and private applicators and those people who are using restricted use pesticides. And also, while I grant that there is some issues with respect to all of us, we don't want to be able to dump any kind of pesticide under our water. We left some of that in. But what I do in this is we went back through, and the big part is, as you go through, I've been back through, and it comes down to penalties. And what the amendment does, if you go to the amendment, is we will look, if you go to 35736, well, if we go to page 3, line 8, of the bill, when you get pesticide, and so you know what, when we talk about pesticides is any substance or mixture of substances intended to preventing, destroying, repelling, or mitigating pests under this. And that, Mr. President, I've used laundry soap and water to remove fungus from my front lawn, sometimes known as sprayer rings. Also use it to wipe off aphids and things, other insects that might be on my tomatoes. But I find out, Mr. President, that under the definition of pesticide, that's a pesticide under this act. And so doing that, what I did is went through here, and I tried to pull that back, Mr. President. And so making sure that no person is able to transport or if you look at the middle of the amendment, what we're doing is inserting the word registered in there, because registered pesticides under the federal act or anything you buy in your store, that would be a registered pesticide. You take it home. So I'm trying to limit it there. I'm going down and looking at the penalties and prohibited acts.
30
seconds. On page 7. Mr.
30
President?
Seconds.
Thank you. Mr. President, if I can, if I'd like to have 2 extra minutes into my second, if I may.
Okay.
And then on page 7, line 13, which is on page 1 of the amendment, we're going, page 7, line 13, I'm making the prohibited acts mostly applicable to only certified applicators and not to any person, but I am pulling in any person and violating the discarding, or if there are other certain things where they're doing things with registered pesticides, that should be applicable to any person. So I did that with those. And then when you came down, I also had changed on prohibited acts that, for example, one of the things that any person was required to do was keep records. And Mr. President, if you don't keep records of the pesticides you apply to your lawn, apparently you're violating the act and committing with your herbicide that you spray on some weed that's coming out of the crack in your driveway. If you haven't kept your records, you potentially have committed a crime. And so we pulled that back and made that apply to certified applicators. We're still not allowing people to falsify or who are trying to become professional applicators or to register pesticides. We're still making it applicable to them. And then finally, we're also making it unlawful for a certified applicator not to keep those records. But in the end, Mr. President, that's what we did. Whether you vote us up or down, I wanted to bring to the body's attention that, in short, the Wyoming Environmental Pesticide Control Act, it goes a lot farther than most of us think. And I was appalled, Mr. President, when I read it. And so vote this up or vote it down. If you're not comfortable with what we're doing, vote against it. But, Mr. President, I thought it was important that sometimes when we go through these things, when we look at these things, it's amazing what the unintended consequences and who can get pulled in the grasp. And also, Mr. President, I was asked, who would I rather have, someone from the Department of Agriculture come and knock on my door and ask to how much pesticide I applied to my lawn, whether I have someone from the FBI, or excuse me, someone from the EPA come and ask me, and my answer was, I would probably tell both of them that it's none of their darn business. And I didn't think the state needed the additional authority. So thank you, Mr. President.
Discussion on the amendment? Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Wow, where do I start? An amendment that totally guts existing regulations, and really does. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there what happens, and I'll kind of start at the back. We're talking about the record keeping. No requirement on general use pesticides to keep any kind of records, zero. They may require it. If they've got abuse of a registered pesticide, they may require it. If you've got something they're having problems with, it can be required. Generally, if that's the case, it'll get moved off the list and will no longer be a general pesticide. The stuff you buy in the grocery store, no records, no problem, it's fine. What this amendment really does is when you go to line 14 and you stick registered in, works great. It's the guys that are certified already. Yeah, it does what it works under existing law. What it does for all of you and your neighbors and the general public, it says that when you go use those lawn chemicals and you throw them in the ditch behind your house, or you throw them in the stream bank and pollute somebody's well or waterway, that you can be charged with littering. We've let you off on everything else. What this section of the law does is says you're going to dispose of things properly. And that's not just for the guys that have been trained for certified or commercial. It's for everybody. It's a common sense piece, and this is where it's regulated in the law. When you go down to line 22, you're into a very similar deal. It says any person violating any provision of the statutes is guilty of a misdemeanor. This is the penalty portion of it. We just debated a law about having accidents and having problems. Is there anything wrong with being fined $500 for doing something absolutely bad or maybe even going to jail? We're talking chemicals that, for a lot of people, they seem pretty innocent. They really aren't that innocent if you start dumping them or disposing of them improperly. Some penalty for doing that beyond littering is probably not out of the question. I will also tell you, this stuff's been in the law for a little bit of a guess here, but probably at least since the 70s. Don't know of a single person that's been done. The only way that you'd ever find this happen is if you're having problems. They're going to propagate some rules, or they're going to come after you if you're being really bad about it, probably on a distribution level. As far as the B, unlawful certified applicators refuse to keep records required by the director, it's not necessary right now. That's one of the conditions of using restricted use of pesticides. You have to keep records. You have to have a license to buy them. You have to keep records and keep them on file. And the state does come check on those. They'll show up. I've never heard of the state ever showing up anybody's place about improperly stored pesticides. The only way you're going to get them to show up on a common person from the store is if you've got some leaking and somebody called you in. You're probably going to get a department ag guy show up and say, hey, you got something going on, your neighbor's got something happening over here. With that being said, I could go on for a long time, but this amendment, if you pass it as it is, you've just gutted probably one of the best protection laws you've got to keep from having problems around your place. So I'd encourage you to defeat this amendment and go ahead and pass it.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. In regards to the good senator's representation that he's never heard of anybody, the state ever showing up at anybody's place, well, let me tell you, they do. Fortunately, Mr. President, I wasn't the one raising potatoes last year when the state showed up with a couple of people and they were going to do a complete sweep and inventory and everything else. But fortunately, we grew no potatoes in Wyoming that year, the guy that was leasing my place. And so he was exempt from that type of inspection. But this was the Gestapo coming in to say hello. So, Mr. Chairman, that being said, looking at page 142.34, line 42.3 and 4 and 5 as far as the records, you know, folks, certified applicators, for the most part, they'll keep a pretty good record. But a certified applicator, a registered applicator, it's relatively simple to do. You just go down to the Weed and Pest, puts a program on a couple times a year. It takes you 4 or 5 hours to go through, have lunch, and they give you the dog and pony show about what you're supposed to know, and then give you a short test afterwards, and then you're a registered or certified applicator. But after that, Mr. President, what you have to keep. It's fairly simple, but you have to really, when you apply things, it's really, and it's like the wind speed, the temperature, the direction, the temperature, all those things, the acres, and all those are relatively simple. But to let the department do it, because now you can do it with your spray rigs will have a computer chip. You can pull that thing out. It's got it, all that information in there. You load it all into your tractor before you go spraying. Or the next guy might have a yellow sheet of paper and a tablet. You know, for the department to say what you're going to have in their form, when they probably wouldn't have a clue how to read your computer chip in the first place, I think it's just a little bit ridiculous, Mr. President. So, you know, for us to put it in statute that these guys are going to tell us how we're going to do our jobs when it's really fairly common practice about what you know, what you have to have. The federal government kind of tells you in one stage anyway that the basis that you're going to have for applying these things and keeping track of them. So to keep this, Mr. President, I've got a little heartburn with. And then the situation that I had heard is why you took registered out in the first place is because even though there are some things that are totally innocuous to the environment, like soap and water to do some of these things, there are other things that have been around there, like Paris green, which is essentially arsenic that was, has been off and is not labeled, but it had an intended use years ago. And so if you got somebody that throws this thing out that's not registered, they're out of the ballpark, but he could run that out over somebody's pasture if he didn't like them and kill every head of sheep in the pasture. And there's no law against it unless you pass this and kill this amendment.
Draw those bills up there. Draw those bills.
See those? Further discussion. Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think there's possibly some unintended consequences that could occur here. Now, I was once certified pesticide applicator, no longer. So I go down to Walmart or go down to a big box store, and I buy some XYZ pesticide, herbicide, and on the label it says you must follow these rules. Okay, so I don't. And pretty soon, with this amendment, I think it will probably dry up the supply in these big box stores. They're saying, we don't want to have to deal with this. We just won't sell. Wyoming's not a big market. And pretty soon I won't be able to get my weed be gone. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Perkins.
Mr. President, believe it or not, I know I only have, I think, 3 minutes. This guy is not following with this amendment. Now, I can say, you can vote it down, you can vote it up. My guess is you probably voted down because it's a lot coming to you at Second Amendment. But let's talk about what registration is. When we talk about registered pesticides, in the Act, it's not in your bill, but in the Act, 357-356 registration, every pesticide or device which is distributed within this state or delivered for transportation or transported intrastate commerce or between points within this state through any point outside the state, shall be registered with the Department of Agriculture by its manufacturer or formulator and subject to the provisions of this Act. So every pesticide that you pick up at the store, that you buy anywhere else, that's transported anywhere, has to be registered. Nothing in the amendment affects that. What we're talking about, the only thing when we talk about registered pesticides, we're talking about every pesticide that's got a label on it, every pesticide you buy in your store, anything that's got a label on it, that's a registered pesticide. So what are we doing with that? Why is that important? Because there are home remedies, and because you have an overreach, because you have individuals who have the right to be in your garden, to fix your aphids, to do things like that, to do without the worrying about the interference. Now, let's talk about what we did do on penalties, on the prohibitions. All we did is we removed the provisions that were appropriate for certified applicators. We made them appropriate to certified applicators. For any other person, we included this improper disposal of, is still in there. If you improperly dispose of any registered pesticide, you're still liable. If you don't store it right, you're still liable. If you don't use it right, you're still liable. So we have that. And then the only thing we did is all we did is we took certain parts that were applicable to everyone. We left them in one place. Then in the amendment, we take down the things that are applicable to certified applicators. We made sure that they were only, which particularly are records, keeping the records were only available to certified applicators. So, you know, this is what we hear every time that the government comes in and we find out the government can't, you know, that the government is there, and by golly, if we don't take care of ourselves, that the world will come to an end because the government has a little bit of limited power. So, you know, you vote against it. I don't care if you vote against it, but I wanted to bring it to your attention today that there's another important, as we've talked about before, there's another place that amazingly, when you find out the reach and the scope of the government, not just the federal government, but our state government, how far it comes into our lives, sometimes it's pretty surprising. Thank you, Mr. President.
Question is, shall second reading amendment number 1, Senate File 160 pass? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendments passed. Senate File 160 having been read 2 separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a 3rd time? Hearing no objection is so ordered. Do we have time to... Do they have any amendments on those? Huh? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Are we at that time for a noon recess?
Well, the question, Mr. Majority Floor Leader,
I know
5 till and...
I know. We haven't done 3rd reading. Anything else left?
I think it's probably appropriate. It looks like there's a number of amendments on 3rd reading.
Well, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand in recess until 1 o'clock.
Announcements?
1 o'clock. Now, everybody's going to love this motion, and then we're going to let the Minerals Committee go in and eat first. No, how about 1 o'clock?
1 o'clock.
Because they have a noon recess.
Announcements. Mr. Vice President.
Mr. President, well, what about your friendly Appropriations Committee? Do we? Point of order, Mr. President. No, Mr. President, your Senate Appropriations Committee number 2 will now meet at 12:30 to discuss Senate File 109, Highway and Road Funding Severance Taxes.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet immediately after a fast lunch here and go over House Bill 62, Innocent Landowners Amendment, and House Bill 63, State Primacy on Greenhouse Gas Regulations.
Further announcements? You heard the motion. All those in favor say yes. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Please allow the minerals and the appropriations folks to go get their lunches first.
Heard the motion. All those in favor, Senate stands adjourned until 1 o'clock. A recess.